From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our series of entertaining interviews from 2008. For our last show of the year, we have conversations with some great musicians. This year, REM released their first new CD in 4 years. Singer Michael Stipe, guitarist Peter Buck, and bass player Mike Mills will tell us about REM's 28-year history. And we'll hear from Mick Jones, former lead guitarist of The Clash, and Tony James, who was the bass player of Generation X. In 2002, these two old friends joined forces to form the band Carbon Silicon. After releasing a lot of music on the internet, they released their first official CD this year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a series of entertaining interviews from 2008. On this last day of the year, we're going to hear from the members of two bands, REM and Carbon Silicon. Carbon Silicon isn't nearly as well known as the bands the two co-founders came from. Mick Jones, Carbon Silicon's lead guitarist and singer, was the lead singer of the seminal British punk band The Clash and co-wrote many of the band's songs with Joe Strummer. In fact, in Rolling Stone's list of the 10 best songwriting duos ever, Strummer and Jones were number 3, after Lennon and McCartney and Jagger and Richards. Carbon Silicon's Tony James was the bass player in Generation X, the band that introduced singer Billy Idol. James and Jones formed Carbon Silicon in 2002. They've released a lot of music on the internet, but earlier this year, they released their first full-length CD. It's called The Last Post. When I spoke to them in January, we started with the opening track, which is called The News.
People started caring about what I need, and people started smiling at everyone I meet, and people started looking for good instead of bad. Realize what they could lose and what they always had. People started growing instead of being crushed, and people started slowing down instead of being rushed. People started looking with very different eyes at this information that comes as a surprise. Good morning, here's the news, and all of it is good.
That's the news from the new Carbon Silicon recording, The Last Post. Mick Jones, Tony James, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Mick, your voice has such warmth, and it's a different sound than I associate with the more confrontational style of The Clash.
Well, it's the same voice, obviously. You know what I mean? I used to sing more backup vocals, and Joe used to do the main singing, and now I sort of do the main singing and some of the backing vocals on the record. So that has obviously changed. But as far as being on, we're still like, we're not quite as confrontational in terms of horribleness, but in a nice way, I still feel we are.
Got something to say.
Well, you first played together in the pre-Clash days in a band called London SS. What brought you back together?
Well, we've been best friends for 30-something years, you know, and we never set out to form a band. You know, we just started off with one song called MP3 about giving music away on the internet. This was 5 years ago. And, you know, we didn't sit down and go, oh, let's form a band. We just sat down and went, let's write a song together, you know.
We sort of ended up doing it, really.
Yeah, and it grew into a band because we wrote a lot of songs together, and then we thought maybe we'd go and play live, and then maybe we'd put a record out.
But it sort of came from out from other things, because we've been talking about it before we even started playing together. Again, we've been talking about how can you do music if you're our age and with any meaning, and we were looking for some meaning in everything that we were trying to do in order to bring some value to it.
Yes.
And so we started, like, you know, we could just do this, and we have to get over a lot of horrible truths about ourselves and stuff, but we managed it, and so, like, that stuff don't matter.
Well, let's hear another track from the new Carbon Silicon CD called The Last Post, and I thought we'd hear Caesar's Palace. Before we hear it, why don't you talk about your approach to writing songs together, or specifically to writing this song together?
I just write on the bus and things like that when I'm sitting upstairs, and then I'm trying not to get happy slapped.
I often write a lot of stuff while I'm driving. I sit there with a, dangerous though that is, I sit there with a notepad on my I've on my lap.
That's really dangerous too.
I know, but
especially if you're on the phone with the other hand.
Yeah. I've perfected this way of just scribbling on big sheets of paper on my lap. Something about the rhythm of driving at 70 miles an hour.
That's the same with the bus. It's like gudung, 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 gudung.
Yes.
And that's the way you get the rhythm. It's actually in the air.
Well, let's hear Caesar's Palace from the new Carbon Silicon CD. And this is Mick Jones and Tony James.
I wish we could see where the dreams all went. I wish we could see where the money got spent. I wish we could see that the greatest crime was to fool all of the people to spend all the time. I wish we could see why we need so much stuff. I
wish we could see that enough is enough. I wish we could see that the going's got tough, 'cause my living is crammed and my past is bad tough. Value what is necessary, leave what is not, and tell me what I'm doing in another shot. I wish we could see that we're out of control.
That's Caesar's Palace from the new Carbon Silicon CD, and Carbon Silicon features Mick Jones and Tony James. When you first started playing together in the 70s in a band called London SS,
yes.
What was that band like?
MC5.
Oh.
We did MC5 numbers and Flaming Groovies numbers and the Odd Stones number and numbers off Lenny K's Nuggets. It was all just copy rock stuff.
So it was like garage rock, hard rock, and
it was
a political
tribute to the Standells.
Yeah, kind of very garage rock. Not especially political at that stage.
I just really wanted to be in a band, and also that was a very bad name that we had as well. And so obviously,
SS, you know,
especially we were very ashamed of that. That was like when we were young and stupid, you know.
You know, I have this theory about this band because it never really worked out. That band,
we never played a date or recorded anything or anything.
Somehow,
like that.
I believe that sort of karma stopped that group being a success because it would have been a very negative thing to be propagating.
And it was a load of old rubbish anyway.
You look back
at
the sort of, you know, of your youthful excesses, and you go, this was a stupid idea, guys. But, you know, you look back at that with the experience
of being
50-year-old.
And especially funny because we're back together again, and every person who ever asks a question, everybody brings that up. And so it's our shame that we have to bear every time. We bear it and we try and we feel shame how shameful it is.
But
it
wasn't.
We shouldn't really be talking, like, making a big deal about it.
Yes.
So fed up with it.
I know. We talked for 5 minutes about it.
before you got into a more punk side of things, you were both into glam rock, right?
We like the New York Dolls and Johnny Thunders and those kind of bands.
And the Stooges.
So can you talk about, like, were there two different styles that early in your career you inhabited on stage, both in terms
not at all, really. No. I mean, I think, you know, we came out of, remember, the New York Dolls was 73, you know, so the glam rock period was 72, 73. So,
it was
75 before we were playing.
And by that time, the platforms had got lower.
Yes.
Like, because they were so difficult. Sometimes I used to go down, I had big platforms on, then I'd go head first down the stairs.
That's right.
I was glad all that stopped.
It was an uncomfortable look.
So you did the platform thing and the glitter
before,
and the
eye makeup.
Yeah.
We did the platforms.
74, 75. It was never popular with our parents.
So we went to Bieber's and we bought a load of ocelot-type material, and then we got someone to do us a pair of really tight trousers each.
Yeah.
Do you remember? Almost had to be stitched into these trousers.
Well, Bieber's T-shirts only came in size 0, so you had to be really thin to get them on.
Now, the Sex Pistols were the first, like, really famous punk band. You were already playing when
Well, the Clash were already playing, right?
About a few months before. They were already going, and there was a couple of other groups that were going but didn't have the direction of under the label of punk or something like that. There was bands like the Stranglers were around before, Eddie and the Hot Rods, The Jam was sort of playing already, and there was a load of bands, but they hadn't quite made the proper transition. But the Sex Pistols, when you see them, it was like all over, completely different thing. You know
the
what
Pistols
I mean?
They definitely changed.
They changed things, and that was like the new thing that came in after the Pistols, and all groups that had come before it, they sort of weren't keyed up, if you know what I mean. And then, like, the groups that came after the Pistols, well, there was like a few of them that were, like, kind of good. But I mean, we were always saying that everybody can do it, but you still needed to have a bit of an idea or something.
Because the ironic thing was that look was so powerful, yet people were able to change overnight, because if you had long hair, it was really easy to just go and cut it all off and rip the arms out of your T-shirt, and then you were on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If they'd been the other way around and you had to grow your hair,
it would have taken,
taken years.
Process. Right. But it did actually. And because England's only a small place, you know, Britain's a pretty small place, it spread like wildfire around the country.
And it had taken a while to understand that to be different, suddenly you could have short hair and ripped T-shirts and tight trousers instead
of long
hair.
All that stuff was really
flares.
Important because everybody had flares, right?
Yeah,
and then they looked at you and went, like, bloody hell, if you had straight trousers, it was outrageous.
Mick, can I ask you how you first met Joe Strummer?
Well, Joe was playing in this group, the 101ers.
I mean, we used to go and see him together, didn't we? All the time.
And 101 was like the address of the squat that he was living in?
Yeah. 101 Waterton Road.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they were quite a happening group, really, and he was a really good... And so one day, the rest of us, we approached him, like the manager, and the manager just went to one of his gigs. We all went to one of his gigs, and he went round back and said, I want you to meet these guys, and that was us. And so we kind of like, we arranged that do you want to come round and meet us? And we were all in a squat in Shepherd's Bush, and he came round. And that was when we first probably met him. Although we'd seen him in the Dole office beforehand, and also down Portobello Road, like as you do, you know, sort of nodding, all right, but nothing more. And then he kind of come round to where we were at. And then he said, do you want to join this group, these guys? And Joe could already see the way things were going and went, yeah, I'm in.
So I guess, you know, hearing you sing on Carbon Silicon, I'm wondering, like, why didn't you see yourself as the lead singer of your band?
Oh, you know why? Because I started on like a stylophone, you know, this kind of electronic organ that you hear on David Bowie's Space Oddity. And then I moved up to drums, and then I moved up to bass. And then I thought, I can handle a couple more strings here. And then I started playing guitar. And so I thought it was always cooler just to play the guitar and just like you didn't have to work so hard and pressure wasn't on you. And then after Joe went, sort of stepped up and started doing it. But I always wanted to just do guitar and sing a few backups.
So you didn't want the pressure of being the front man?
Or anything, no.
See, now you know.
You were actually forced out of the band.
Imagine that. That's your own band you get chucked out of. Being chucked out of bands ain't a big deal. It took years to get over, though, traumatically. Yeah. But it used to happen all the time. It was called, can we take you for a drink? And that meant we'd go for a drink, and then it means you're getting fired. Yeah. If you're in a band, it's like, that used to happen all the time, you know. So just we got fed up with each other, basically. Yeah. But it was loads of fun, but... In the end, you know what I mean? I think the bigger we got, the more screwed up we became. Mm. You know what I mean? Because we couldn't. We were trying really hard and we couldn't handle it. It was just too much for us. And the bigger we got, the worse we felt.
How much of like a crisis, an identity crisis even, was it for you?
It was very bad for me.
Pushed out of the Clash.
It was very bad for me. It was so bad. And it was right around the time of the Notting Hill Carnival. And so I couldn't walk around without seeing somebody I knew.
Naturally, my phone's ringing.
And then I kind of tried to disguises for a while. I dyed my hair, put glasses on.
You look like
I grew a beard. I looked like Manson. I went to Paris. I was afraid to see anybody. It was a messed up period, yeah. And then we soon became friends again, that we just never got together again as a group. But
You were putting BAD together pretty quickly, weren't you? And you were helping me
straight away.
Helping me put together Zig Zig Sputnik.
Well, I just want to play one really classic Clash record while you're here. So I thought we'd play London Calling. And Mick Jones, you co-wrote this. Would you talk a little bit about the song, like getting the song together?
Well, there was, at the time of writing it, there was this map that they showed you. If Thames Barrier ever burst its banks, they showed you what part of London would be underwater. And it was like completely all round, all the West End and
everywhere we live
and everything like that. If they ever broke our banks, we'd all be flooded. And that was like the original kind of apocalyptic message of the song.
But I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning.
That's The Clash featuring guitarist Mick Jones with their 1979 recording London Calling. My guests are Mick Jones and Tony James, co-founders of the band Carbon Silicon. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the founders of the band Carbon Silicon, Mick Jones and Tony James. Mick Jones was the lead guitarist of The Clash and co-wrote many of their songs. Tony James played bass in Generation X and Zig Zig Sputnik. Tony, I have a question for you about Zig Zig Sputnik, and this is going to be about how you looked in it. You know, yes. You had talked before about how during punk, hair got shorter and you could change your look. You could just like cut your hair and make it short. But in Zig Zig Sputnik, you had these like really long, spiky things piled up high on your head. Yes. Was that your real hair?
Well, that's why that band took 5 years to get together.
Right. It took 5 years in makeup.
Why
did you head in that direction?
You know what? The colored hair were extensions. They were tied into our hair.
Okay.
And actually, the singer, it was Degville's idea because, you know, he had shared an apartment with Boy George at the time, and they both had this freaky, super extended hair, you know, and it was actually made of bits of fur, like out of these. You used to buy these goat's hair rugs, cut it into little pieces, dye it pink, and tie it into your own hair with pipe cleaners. Hence the word rug. Slang for wigs in English. So all those extensions were tied into my hair, which was long, with pipe cleaners. So it was possible to take the extensions out, you know, on a weekend if you were having a day off.
Thank you for joining us for hair tips.
Yes, but generally having 2 meters of pink hair hanging down your back was a pain in the arse, as were walking around in girls' high-heeled shoes. So it was a bit of a sort of a glam rock revisited, but it was a startling look, you know, and again, set it aside from everything else at the time.
How did it feel to go into that look after coming out of punk?
Well, it was, you know, again, it was shocking because suddenly everybody had short hair and everybody looked normal. So to suddenly look like this space monster was totally fresh, you know. So it was a startling look around London. Not so popular with getting girlfriends, I have to tell you.
Why do you think that was?
Because we look ridiculous.
So now you're on stage looking just like yourself.
Also, I have to say, you end up having sex, and then you get out of bed, and there's half a pile of pink hair still in the bed.
You wouldn't take it off for your intimate moments.
It was a real hazard look for groupies, I tell you.
you wouldn't take all that stuff off.
What? No. Well, that would be really disappointing.
Take too long.
They liked it.
Put it all on the side of the bed.
In moments of extreme passion.
In a glass on the side of the bed.
Girls would pull your hair, and it would come out in their hands. This is before I was married, I have to tell you.
Oh, of course. So now on stage, you look like yourself.
We do. We look like ourselves.
And eventually, we found ourselves.
Yes.
Is it a more...
Hair's not an issue now for
us. Do you feel any
more... No longer an issue.
No longer an issue.
Do you feel any more vulnerable or naked just performing as yourselves without any special clothes or persona on stage?
Actually, I find it now more comfortable going on stage than ever because actually I'm getting up and I'm being really me and it's just about the guitar playing and the singing and the songs. It's not about the image suddenly, although I suppose you could say there is an image, i.e. an image of 50-year-old guys being themselves. But this is not pantomime like Sputnik, and it's not an aggressive look like punk was. It's us being just ourselves.
Mick, another question from an earlier part of your life. You were largely raised by your grandmother.
That's right.
And when you were in The Clash, and The Clash was really big, you were still going home to your grandmother's place for...
Very, very often, yeah. I sometimes get myself a flat for a few months and then I ended up going back to the
For some people, it's so peculiar when you go back to, like, the bedroom that you grew up in after you're an adult.
I know.
And it makes you feel like a child again. So what was it like after being on the road with the Clash to then go home to the bedroom you grew up in at your grandmother's place?
It was it was great, actually. Well, sort of where I learned to play guitar, in the same room. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Because I was like spent a year solid in there playing along with people's records first, and so it was like very good. And then before that, I lived with my grandmother, her sister, and sister-in-law. So it was like I was brought up by like three old ladies. So I suppose it does sound quite peculiar. Mm. But
what about when you signed your first record deal and you paid for your grand to go to America to see your mother because your mother's American?
Yeah, that's right.
And we pretended your grandmother's flat was our flat for 3 weeks.
Yeah, it was great. We had our Rat Pack pad, and it was fantastic.
We'd go clubbing
and pretending it was our flat.
We'd go clubbing and bring girls back and say we had this really cool penthouse flat. It's really his grandmother's house.
How'd your grandmother react when she came home?
Well, we moved it all back again when she got back.
Last day, we knew she was coming back, and she didn't know.
Well, it's really been great to talk with you both. I love the new CD. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope people get some positivity from it.
Mick Jones and Tony James co-founded the band Carbon Silicon. Our interview was recorded in January when they released their CD, The Last Post. Here's another track from it. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I sigh, I sigh, I sigh. There's a conspiracy and trying for a coup. I think we should be free to do what we want to do.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, REM. This year, the band released its first CD in 4 years and a 25th anniversary edition of their first album. We talk with the band's lead singer, Michael Stipe, guitarist Peter Buck, and bass player Mike Mills.
Martha. Monopoly 21, checkers and chess. Yeah, 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 yeah. Mr. Fred Lassie in a breakfast mess. Yeah, 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 yeah. Let's play Twister, let's play Risk. Yeah, 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 yeah. I'll see you in heaven. About this one, tell me, are you locked in the pond? Andy, are you goofing on Elvis too, baby? Are we losing touch? If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with entertaining interviews from 2008. In April, I spoke with the band REM. Let's start with a track from their debut album, Murmur.
We'll be right back.
That's Radio Free Europe from REM's debut album Murmur. The song was originally released as a single in 1981 and got a lot of play on college radio. Murmur was released in 1983. Rolling Stone named it the best album of the year, over records by Michael Jackson and The Police. A special 25th anniversary remastered edition of Murmur was released earlier this year. REM has endured for three decades, continuing to be known for maneuvering their way through the recording industry while holding on to their integrity. Last year, the band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. When I spoke to lead singer Michael Stipe, guitarist Peter Buck, and bass player Mike Mills, they had just released Accelerate, REM's first CD in 4 years. Here's a track from it called Man-Sized Wreath.
TV, what do I see? A pageantry of empty gestures all lined up with me. Wow! I'd have thought by now we would be ready to proceed, but a tearful hand to tug the heart in a man-sized wreath. Ow! Throw it on the fire.
Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, Mike Mills, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you.
Now, the new CD has 11 songs, and it's about 34, 35 minutes long, which is really short for a CD. Why did you want to keep it that short?
Well, you know, when it was vinyl that was the medium, the physical content size of the piece of plastic meant that you had to clock in at 40 minutes or less, or you would overload the grooves and you would lose any sort of sonic quality. And then when they came out with CDs, people went, oh my God, I can put an hour and 20 minutes of music on this thing. And unfortunately, a lot of people did, including us. So we just realized that it was, you know, it might be a good idea at this point in our career to rein it in a little bit and see. It's a lot of fun to say what you have to say in a really short amount of time. And if you can do that, and if you can really get a message across and pack it with a pretty powerful punch in less than 3 minutes or less than 3.5 minutes, then it's quite an accomplishment.
So it was a good songwriting exercise for you.
Yes, yes.
Well, let me play a song from the new CD that I think is a new song that's exciting. And it's called Houston, and it's sung from the point of view of someone after Hurricane Katrina. And, Mike, I want to ask you about the organ or synthesizer that you're playing on this. It's so dark and so ominous. I really like the sound of it. I have no idea what you're doing.
Well, that makes two of us. It's actually what happened was I wandered into the studio and Peter and Scott McCoy were playing that song on guitars, and I didn't know it. I'd never heard it before. So I just sat down and started playing what came to mind, and that's pretty much what's on the record. I didn't know what Michael was going to write about lyrically, but I felt the darkness of the song, and I wanted a really angry keyboard sound. I didn't know why, but I did. And then so it's basically just a nasty farfisa run through a big old rat pedal, and then on top of that, we've got some more of the darkness and anger of that song. It exists in the bass. The idea of Scott McCoy came up with the idea. It's a bass through a really nasty fuzz pedal, doubled with a bowed upright bass, also through some nasty fuzz. And you know, we just knew it was a big, ugly, kind of scary sound. And then after Michael put the lyrics on it, we realized, oh my God, it sounds like a hurricane going by, which, you know, we're never quite that literal, you know, with the music and the lyrics combining, but it happened that way, and it's just an excellent combination.
I think it's one of those cases where the music, the original music inspired me to write that lyric. And then you guys, having heard that lyric, you took that original music and made it
even more so.
Mm-hmm. And it is a very ominous musical landscape.
Peter, do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
Well, yeah, Michael said he wanted songs that were a minute and a half long, so when I wrote it, I had a clock, and I just looked at the minute hand, and after a minute and a half, I was done. We just put as much stuff on there as we could. So it's not always about the forethought, you know. Sometimes it just occurs, and it just got uglier and weirder, I have noticed that the more cinematic something is when you give it to Michael, the more it'll catch his ear.
Why don't we hear Houston? This is from REM's new album, Accelerate.
Well, I've got to get that out of my head. It's a new day today and the coffee is strong. I've finally got some rest. So a man's put to task and challenges. I was taught to hold my head high. Let what is mine make the best of what today has. Houston is filled with promise. Laredo's a beautiful place. And Galveston sings like that song that I love. Its meaning has not been erased. And so there are claims forgiven.
That's Houston from REM's new CD, Accelerate, and my guests are Michael Stipe, the vocalist, Peter Buck, guitarist, Mike Mills, who plays bass and keyboards. Let's go back to when you all met in Athens, Georgia, and this would be about what year?
About 1979.
Okay. Can you each describe something about how you knew you could play with the others, that this would work, that you were compatible musically?
Well, when we first got together in the old abandoned church, I remember it was freezing. That's all I remember. It was really, really cold. Bill Berry and I had played together in bands in Macon, Georgia, and we had a couple of songs that we'd written back then, and we showed them to Peter and Michael, and I remember just loving what they both did with the songs. Peter played guitar in a way that I'd never really heard anyone play before, and even then Michael had a really great grasp on how to sing, and it was very different from how I would have done it, which is what I was looking for. So I just remember thinking, you know, I can do stuff with these guys.
What was different about Peter's guitar playing than what you'd heard before?
Peter...
More inept.
The finest ineptitude ever heard by man. Peter plays with an arpeggiated style. He has, I love saying this phrase, he has the best right hand in the business. But instead of just thrashing away and strumming chords, which, you know, what everyone does, and it all tends to sound the same, you can really create melody after melody after melody by arpeggiating with the right hand, which is what Peter does, and it just opens up all this space for me to noodle around on the bass, and it just hadn't, I hadn't really heard it that much at that point.
Peter, how did you start playing that way?
You know, I remember really liking the Birds, the band The Birds, when I was learning to play guitar, and I was so ignorant about music that, not realizing that Roger was finger picking and using four fingers, I just worked really hard to imitate him using a flat pick. And by the time I actually figured out that he was doing this kind of folk finger picking thing, I was kind of flat picking in a way that was a little different, and kind of, I don't know, it wasn't my own style necessarily, but it was at least a start.
And Peter, what made you realize that you wanted to play with the other members of REM who weren't yet REM?
Yeah, you know, it really was just the first rehearsal. I mean, within a day or two, we had 8 or 10 kind of original songs. I mean, as original as we were writing at that time anyway. And they sounded good, you know. We got better as songwriters, but it seemed to fit together really well immediately, which, you know, is for what I've heard later from other people, doesn't usually happen.
And Michael?
I felt like we had to write 20 or 25 songs before we really knew what we were doing, because none of us were that proficient on our instruments. Mike and Bill probably more so than Peter and I. When I started the band, it didn't occur to me that I would have to write lyrics. I kind of had this kind of teenage fantasy idea of what it was to be in a band and to be able to tour and what have you, and it didn't include the actual work. So it took me a while to come around to that.
The impression I got from the first time we spoke in the 90s is that when you started singing, you were just a little shy about it.
I was a little shy about everything. I think I was pathologically so.
My guests are Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills from the band REM. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with singer Michael Stipe, guitarist Peter Buck, and bass player Mike Mills of the band REM. This year they released a new CD called Accelerate and a 25th anniversary edition of their first album, Murmur. Michael, you had said that in 1985 you felt that you started to come into your own and get more comfortable, you know, as a songwriter and performer. 2 years later, in 87, REM had its first real hit, The One I Love. And I'm wondering if you knew when you recorded this that this was somehow going to be different, if it felt musically like something happened that hadn't happened before.
I always said, and I think I probably stole this from Peter or Mike, I always said that I wouldn't know a hit single if it was sitting in my lap. And I feel like perhaps the producer that we were working with on that record had an idea that that song could make it onto the radio, or that our time had come to be a top 40 radio band, but I certainly didn't recognize that.
It was my, I think, eighth favorite song on that record.
Really?
So it wasn't, you know, it was like, oh yeah, we put it on side two. It was kind of, but you know, that's fine. I mean, it wasn't, we didn't write it for any particular reason other than that we just wrote it and it popped up and then it was a kind of a hit. And you know, I mean, hit singles are kind of meaningless in their way. I mean, it's just a song that you wrote that day.
I remember talking to when we were making Document, there was something on Document that I really thought was a really great song. It might have been End of the World, I'm not even sure. Thinking, you know, okay, we've had a hit. Maybe this is another one. I remember asking Scott Litt, you know, when people are making these things, I was like, for example, when Petula Clark and her producers were making Downtown, did they know what they were doing? Did they know what a great song they had? He goes, yep. So, you know, sometimes people know and sometimes you don't.
One thing that sounds different to me in this era of the band is I think, Michael, your voice is more out front as opposed to more in the mix. And I guess I'm wondering how everybody felt about that.
Well, you know, that was fine. When we did the first record, I had a kind of picture in my head that, you know, it would be, wow, this weird kind of, you know, like some record from the 60s that you just can't figure out what the context was. It's just kind of this beautiful artifact. And you know, we weren't really guaranteed that we were going to get to do 5 records or 14 or whatever. I mean, I was kind of thinking, well, we'll get this record and maybe if we're really lucky, we'll get another one. And you know, Murmur, that first record, that was kind of what I thought it should be. It's kind of like a radio beacon from some other planet, you know. I mean, certainly if we thought, you know, radio airplay was important, Murmur wouldn't sound like it does. But I think if we had thought radio airplay was important, we would have made a not very good record.
Well, why don't we hear The One I Love from 1987, since we had been talking about that. And this is REM, and my guests are Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills.
This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to
That's REM from 1987, and my guests are Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills of REM. They have a new CD, which is called Accelerate. That song led to a recording contract with Warner Brothers. How did it change your lives on the road to have like a major label behind you and the money for a tour? How did it change like how you got around, where you stayed, what your day-to-day life was like?
It was exactly the same.
Really that different?
Yeah.
Really?
You know, I mean, you know, we just went out and played some more.
We broke even or made money on every single tour we ever did from the very beginning.
Which is rare.
Which is rare, but I mean, you see all these people screaming that they can't tour without corporate support and record company support. That's just not true. We broke even or made money every single time without any help from the record label. It was all, you know, we lived within our means and took the door from the places we played, and we lived in you know, one hotel room or one van or whatever it took. We didn't want to be in debt to anyone. We didn't want anyone to have any control over what we did, so we did whatever was necessary to maintain our freedom, and it worked out really well.
I want to jump ahead to 1991, to your recording "Losing My Religion," and I think it's a perfect record. I mean, it's a great song, great singing, and I love the mandolin on it, and the strings. Peter, let's start with the mandolin. Like, what made you think of a mandolin for this?
You know, I think I was on the 89 tour, and I just bought a mandolin. I mean, it was just that simple. I had a day off in New York and found this kind of strange. You know, I'm not sure what, it wasn't an American mandolin, it was like Greek or something, and it just, I mean, it was just something to do on the bus, you know, plunk around at the thing. And so I kind of wrote it on mandolin. I didn't have any great foresight, and I never really played mandolin that much. I mean, I think if you added up the amount of time I played mandolin in my life, it might be 50 hours, and 49 hours that would be playing Losing My Religion on stage. So it's not as if I've, you know, I didn't become an expert at it. It just became just one of those things I started using. And I guess I was hanging around with a bunch of folk musicians, and that kind of just entered my life a little bit.
And Michael, the phrase "losing my religion," is that what came first to you lyrically? And how did it come to you as the title phrase of the song?
I don't remember writing the song at all. I remember singing it in the studio, but I don't remember writing it. But the phrase comes from, I actually changed it. The phrase is "lost my religion," and it's a Southern phrase that indicates something that has pushed you so far that you question your faith.
It's kind of like the 20s version of "blowing my mind."
Okay, so I'm gonna play it. This is REM, "Losing My Religion." That's REM, and my guests from REM are Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills, and they have a new CD, which is called Accelerate. There was a period, skipping ahead just a few more years, in 1995 when nearly everyone in the band was sick. The drummer, then Bill Berry, collapsed on stage with a brain aneurysm. Peter, you had surgery for, I think, an intestinal adhesion.
That was Mike.
No, that was Mike.
I've never been
sick. Yeah.
I'm still healthy.
Good.
Peter was looking both ways before he crossed the road.
Yeah, I was definitely just going, well, you know.
and Michael, you had emergency surgery for a hernia. A couple of years after that, Bill left the band. And from what I've read, he said that he wasn't going to leave if it meant that the band would split up. And you decided to all stay together. Was that the only time you've come close to breaking up?
Now, you know, I think being in a band is an ongoing process, and I think that everyone at one point or another thinks, you know, I could just walk away from it. And it's kind of nice knowing that you can walk away from it. I can't imagine how resentful it would be if you just felt like, okay, I can never leave this band.
Yeah.
But the freedom to walk away means that you don't have to. You know, we're totally able to to work and take some time off, you know, and it's still an option to walk away from it. But it isn't something that I want to do.
We've always given each other the freedom to do whatever we want outside the band, which is, you know, not a difficult thing to grant, and it's also helpful. I mean, you go out and you play with other people, you bring back certain inspirations and ideas that you might not have had within your little four walls, and it can be well to your advantage to do that.
We'll talk more with the band REM after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with singer Michael Stipe, guitarist Peter Buck, and bass player Mike Mills of the band REM. This year, they released a new CD called Accelerate and a 25th anniversary edition of their first album, Murmur.
I'd like to ask you each about your music background, which some of which is so not the image of, like, the indie band performer. Like, Mike, you were in marching band, which must have really been fun. I love marches.
It was great fun. I played. I carried a sousaphone around for a year, year or two, and then we switched it over to electric bass for the high school football games. And I had somebody tote my bass out onto the field, and I stood there in a leisure suit and played electric bass while
I wish I'd seen the band.
You can see my high school yearbook sometime. It's got me in there.
And Peter, I read that your first live concert was seeing Jesus Christ Superstar in 1970. Is that right?
Yeah, with my mom. And the guy next to me handed me a joint. I was 12.
Did you take a toke?
You know, I just looked at it, and I looked at my mom, and I just kind of looked straight ahead. it wasn't really my thing. Actually, the first actual live performance I ever saw of music was when I was in second grade, and we lived in Richmond, California, which is near San Francisco. And it was like 1964 or 5, and this band came in, and I remember they did... Turn, 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 and Help by the Beatles. They had a 12-string guitar. They came to our school and played at lunch hour. I have no idea why. And I just remember thinking, that's cool. And all the little girls got, you know, their arms autographed and stuff. It was all over for me then.
Michael, do you remember your first concert or your first, like this is really great music experience?
Well, my first great music experience, I think, is probably discovering punk rock when I was 15, and I went and bought the Patti Smith album, Horses, the day that it was released.
Were you
decided then and there that that's what I was going to do with my life, was sing in a band.
When you'd go to a club and hear punk rock, were you like a quiet, restrained listener, or did you, you know, like jump up and down and do the whole thing?
I jumped up and down and did the whole thing, but I also, my kind of like incredible geek moment, or one of them, is that I was supposed to be 21 years old, so I had a fake ID that said I was 24. I had really curly hair at the time and chest hair, which was really rare for a 16, 17-year-old. So I would wear my shirt unbuttoned down to my belly button to show the chest hair, because I thought that made me look older. And I would pick my hair out so that it looked like an afro, and I'd wear platform shoes. So I was at the punk rock show in platform shoes with a big afro and my own shirt. Yeah. It was a little bit of a mixed message going on there.
Wow.
But I did see some – I saw some pretty good – well, I got in the club. I mean, that's the good news.
Right.
I did see some pretty amazing bands, and I took pictures of most of them with my camera, with my father's camera, actually, that I would always carry with me back then.
Okay. Wow. Well, it's been great to talk with you all. Thank you so much.
Terry, yes, thanks. Indeed. Thanks so much.
Song.
That's It's the End of the World as We Know It from R.E.M.'s 1987 album Document. Our interview with Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills was recorded in April. So that ends our last show of 2008. There's so much we want to wish you for the new year, like less anxiety than this year about money, keeping or finding a job, and health insurance. Wishing for peace throughout the world may be asking too much, but let's hope for the best. We wish you and everyone you love health and happiness in 2009. Happy New Year from all of us at Fresh Air. From Danny Miller, Roberta Shurrock, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, John Myers, John Sheehan, Dorothy Farabee, Bob Hurdick, Audrey Bentham, Dave Davies, and David Bianculli. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare. On the web at kauffman.org. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we start the new year in good company with Steve Martin. We'll talk about his career as a stand-up comic and why he had to end that chapter of his life. It's the subject of his memoir, Born Standing Up. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.